Blog Talk Radio.
United this Sunday night. How's everybody out there doing? Jerry, how are you?
I'm doing well, Jamie. How are you doing?
I'm good, Jerry. What's new with you? What's been going on this weekend?
Not much, man. Not much at all. Did you see the BAFTA awards?
I didn't. I wanted to ask you about the winners of that. When did that air?
It was today.
Tonight, like on the BBC or something, right?
Yeah. It's all about the King's Speech, which isn't really a surprise at all. Fincher did get for Best Director. Fincher got Director, but everything else is in the big awards is the King's Speech. Best Film, Outstanding British Film, Original Screenplay. Aaron Sorkin got for The Social Network. Colin Firth got it. Natalie Portman got it. Jeffrey Rush and Helena Bonham Carter in the supporting category.
Really? Okay.
Alexander Desplat got it for the score. I mean, it did really well in the big, big categories.
Hmm. Well, that's great. You know what interests me is that I don't know what it is with the British film industry, but it's dominated. They're dominated by American titles.
But then again,
it seems like the Oscars are dominated with some British candidates as nominees as well every year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's odd. Well, Roger Deakins got it for cinematography. Editing went to Social Network. Inception got production design, special visual effects and sound. Costume went to Alice in Wonderland, and that got makeup and hair as well. And Toy Story 3 got animated film. And film not in the English language went to The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which I have no problem with. I don't understand how anyone does their foreign language, how they determine, you know. I have no idea. But
What do you mean?
Well, no, I mean, it's like for the Golden Globes, it's really strange. For the Indie Spirit Awards, it's very odd. I think the most clear-cut one is the Oscars, at least, because every country has one film to pick. Outside of that, though, it seems very tricky. It's not as clear-cut. The Oscars, actually, is the one place where it's really clear-cut. One country, one film. That's it. With the Globes, I don't understand how that works at all.
And The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo was not eligible for an Oscar, right? Because it was originally aired on television?
That's what I thought. That was the impression I was under, yeah. They're all TV. They're all made for television, Scandinavian television.
Well, it is interesting. And that foreign picture race for the Oscars is going to be odd, too, because they usually go with an oddball choice. And, all these different ones are getting press, different levels of press now. And
right.
Dogtooth, I suppose Dogtooth is the real dark horse in the race because, this was a movie no one expected to be nominated, especially as it was reported this past week that Academy members were just mystified by it and a little disgusted by it.
Really?
This is a movie that deals with... I think it's Dogtooth that deals with incest and animal cruelty, and there's lots of controversial, kind of borderline distasteful.
Right. Okay. It's on Netflix Instant. I think you can watch it if I'm not mistaken. You can watch it on Netflix.
Yeah, but they were shocked that it was nominated because it seemed that none of the Academy members actually liked it. Even the director said, I was completely shocked. He said, I was shocked to be in the running, like the top among the 12 or however many they culled from.
Wow, okay. Damn.
But who knows? And then I hear lots of great stuff about In a Better World. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a wide open race. I don't know. I mean,
for the Oscars, certainly.
I mean, you would think that Beautiful would be the front runner, but
Pan's Labyrinth and Amelie for their years. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So.
And
knows?
Does anyone remember who actually won that those years? I mean, do the winners of that category have the legs that the ones that everyone expected to win have?
No. Probably not. The Lives of Others has better legs, but the other one that won over Amelie, No Man's Land, it was a good movie, but I mean, that doesn't have, you don't hear that often talked about. Very rarely do you hear that talked about.
Yeah.
But you're right.
We're trying to get our chat room open. I don't know what the dealio is, but we'll get that open. And in a little while, we'll be joined, I think, by our home entertainment correspondent, Arenada Diaz, and we'll review some of the great home entertainment releases that have come out in the past month and a half. Some terrific titles. Man, I've got like a stack of Criterions here that are just wonderful. I'm salivating over.
That's cool. Besides broadcast news, what other one do you have? What other one?
Well, the Sam Fuller movies.
Uh-huh.
The Double Life of Veronique.
Oh, that's a very good one. I like all those so far that you mentioned.
Fish Tank.
If I had to redo my list from 2009, Fish Tank would be the best film of 2009.
Are you kidding? Really?
That would be my top, and I would give Katie Jarvis the Oscar for Best Actress over anyone else.
That's the best, that won the best picture at Cannes that year, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, Fish Tank is an incredible film. We watched it, we watched it in January of last year. It came on demand, and I would have to say that I would have given Katie Jarvis just the Oscar, even though she wasn't nominated, I would have given her an Oscar because I thought her performance was head and shoulders above anyone else's that year.
Yeah. And, of course, Criterion has Blowout coming out the end of April.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
That would be good. That would be an awesome. I would like to buy that in Fish Tank. I'll definitely buy on Blu-ray.
God, what a great movie, Blowout.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
If anyone out there doubts us, check out our tribute to Blowout.
Yeah, really.
In our archives. Speaking of tributes and series and things on Movie Geeks United, we're going to have our Oscar series coming up next week, in the week running up to the Oscars. Mm. Wow. No, not yeah, next week.
Yeah,
May,
yeah, next week, yeah.
The 21st through whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And right now we have the editor Black Swan, Andrew Weissbloom, the cinematographer of Social Network, Jeff Cronenwith, and the director of Inside Job, Charles Ferguson. That's all part of the series that will air starting on the 21st. Franco's come out and he said, you know, if we tank at the Oscars as co-hosts, you know, what's the big deal? It's just a night.
Yeah. I saw that, yeah.
Which, that's his, and you got to respect that about him, is that he has an attitude like, you know, it's not, no sweat, it's not the end of the world. I mean, he's cool as a cucumber, man. I mean, that's good.
Yeah, it is.
He's like Jeff Spicoli, you know?
I mean, he doesn't really have any. This is just something, you know, it's on to the next thing after this, you know? He doesn't care. The man's got a full plate, you know, so he doesn't really care. I mean, you know, when he'll do it, he say, I've hosted the Oscars, and boom, he'll go on to what's next. So.
Well, that's good, too, because it seems like he's all the success that's kind of come his way, and it's, you know, because for a long time, everyone was saying about Franco, man, when's he going to break out? When's it going to happen? Because he did the James Dean movie, which was a TV project. Then he got the part opposite De Niro in City by the Sea, which on paper sounded like a better prestige project than it turned out to be.
Right, true.
And then, you know, everyone was saying, man, this is the next great young actor.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's finally in his zone, but he has an attitude that I think is very healthy. He's just take it as it comes, roll with the punches, enjoy the ride kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, he said after doing movies like Flyboys and Annapolis and Tristan and Isolde, he goes, you do these movies, they all come out around the same time, none of them are very good, you put in like, you do all this work for them, but you're just like, when you watch him, you're just like, wow, what was this all for? And, you know,
yeah.
He said Pineapple Express was the first movie, that and Milk, that he was really proud of. Those are the first movies he was really proud of that he did.
Well, yeah. It's fascinating because I know Newsweek does it, Hollywood Reporter does it. I don't remember which roundtable from those two that I saw this on, but they have nominees all together from different categories, just chatting back and forth. And some of them are recorded before the nominations come out, so there's some that were in the running but didn't make it.
Yeah.
But all the same, it's fascinating. Their dialogue back and forth. And Michelle Williams was talking about playing Marilyn Monroe on one of them, which that's her upcoming movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then Franco was there. And they went back and forth, Franco talking about playing James Dean and Michelle Williams about playing Marilyn Monroe and the different kinds of techniques and observations that they'd make in the process to build that those characters from real life. That's an interesting acting conversation.
Yeah, no, those are very interesting, but it is weird the way they do that before the nominations are released.
Yeah, and generally the moderators are not great. I mean, they ask kind of the most pedestrian question. So the real joy in it is when the participants start to speak to each other,
right?
Back and forth. That's really the moderator's purpose on those roundtables, is to facilitate that kind of back and forth. But there's a pre-show before the Oscars this year that's going to run an hour and a half.
Wow.
Did you know that?
No, I did not. What's the pre-show?
Well, it's ABC's thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they usually do the half hour before the Oscars.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And now since they no longer have Baba Wawa, they're doing the whole hour and a half as a pre-show.
Wow.
That's a lot.
Oh, my God.
But we get that stuff on E.
Yeah, I mean.
So I bet you E will be hurting. From their viewers that normally watch the pre-show there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very strong possibility. I wasn't aware of that. Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, great, fascinating stuff. You know what else fascinates me? A story that I saw that you tweeted. Yes, I pay attention to your tweets.
Oh, God, I feel sorry for you. Okay. But what story was it? Which one?
That someone is financing Paul Thomas Anderson's next movie.
Just like an heiress. She's financing both of them. She's like, she's worth so much money. I don't know her. I don't remember her name. I don't
she's
want to
25
say.
Years old.
Well, God bless her. And God bless her for picking a really awesome filmmaker to do this. I did not realize, though, what I was not aware of. I thought Inherent Vice, because it's based on a property, I thought that would have no trouble finding financing. I was not aware it's for that and the Scientology movie. I was all thought the Inherent Vice, because he's adapting it, I would have thought that would have had backers, but it didn't.
Huh.
But this is fascinating.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, this is like a true artist at the top of his game.
Yeah.
I mean, he's making a masterpiece like each time out.
Mm-hmm. That's, you're absolutely right.
But I'm really curious, like, what kept his...
I'm going to find it right now. I'm going to find it.
His thinly veiled Scientology film from happening.
Okay, here, I found the article. Let me see. It was first reported by Vulture. Megan Allison, the 25-year-old super-rich daughter of the head of Oracle.
Okay.
She may be throwing money PTA's way. She used to be a party girl, but seems to have figured out a better way to spend her money. She helped finance True Grit.
Mm.
And they're thinking, so this might, they think the money might be able to definitely help The Master, but also Inherent Vice.
The Master.
That's
Okay, that's the working title of P.T. Anderson's. And it's Philip Seymour Hoffman as the head of some pseudo-religion.
Right.
Who's kind of uncovered for not necessarily representing all that he claims throughout the course of the movie. I mean, I'm anxious to see it. But you wonder why, because it was greenlit, the project, and then it was dropped. And was this a case of, you know, pressure put on them from certain factions?
Right, yeah. You know, we were talking about that when we brought that up last year. It was either that, but remember he said that he had hit a brick wall. He couldn't almost go often. Or someone said that he had hit a brick wall. But I don't buy that. I just find it.
Well, what was that brick wall? I mean, they said that he said that he had problems with the third act or something, but I don't know. I think the third act might be, you know, a certain organization. Yeah, I mean, who knows?
Right.
Who knows? But that's exciting.
It's very exciting.
Because I've often thought, man, if I had millions upon millions of dollars, would I give it to, like, Coppola to make Megalopolis?
Yeah, I mean, that would be awesome to see that. I mean,
you know, the answer's probably not.
Or would you give it to Michael Cimino?
Oh, gosh, man. Man, what a waste that would be. I'd have to wait 30 years for anyone to appreciate what came out of it.
I know.
So what else is new? Hey, Jerry, did you see the new Justin Bieber flick?
No, I did not, but I did see
Eagle.
Come on, man. I saw the Eagle.
Okay.
You're not excited about that.
That's a close second, I guess.
That is. Thank you. I like the Eagle is pretty good. I liked it.
Does it soar?
You really do want to get us on the poster, don't you? Yes, it soars.
The Eagle
soars. It's very good. I don't know if I like it better than the Neil Marshall one that came out during the summer, Centaurin, but it's pretty good, though. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it for what it was. I do think Rome, that's the series Rome, really did make everyone up their game.
Kevin MacDonald, Last King of Scotland guy.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good movie. I was looking through his resume last night. Yeah, Last King of Scotland, State of Play. I really thought this was a really decent movie. That was good. I enjoyed it.
Always liked State of Play.
Yeah, that was a good one. Yeah.
You hear Christopher Nolan is planning to do a Howard Hughes movie now.
Really? Okay. Wow. All right.
Oh, you didn't know that?
No, I didn't know that. What would be his angle?
His movie after
Dark Knight Rises.
His angle would be the latter part of Hughes's life. It's based on a biography that came out
that'd be
a few years ago. So someone else has beaten Warren Beatty to the punch because Warren Beatty is so slow in getting anything going. I mean, it was Warren Beatty's longtime desire to make this movie, I think.
Wasn't Before the Aviator, weren't the Hughes brothers at one point wanted to do something on Howard? Was it them or they? Someone wanted to do a Howard Hughes project. Before the Aviator, there was one. There was another one in the works. Nicolas Cage was going to be in or something. This was in the 90s, I remember. So, and obviously it's dried up, but.
Yeah, well, Christopher Nolan wants to do it, and that's a challenge. But he it's been 10 years since The Aviator. He wants to release it late, or he wants to release it, I think, 2014.
So that'd be like 10 years, after The Aviator. That's not a problem. I don't see why we can't have another one, especially one that deals with a different part of the later part of his life. I think that'd be fine. There's some new rumors about The Dark Knight Rises casting rumors I just read about.
Oh, yeah?
Marion Cotillard is supposedly joining the cast.
Uh-huh.
So
it'll be a big old fat Chris Nolan reunion.
Yeah, I know. It does seem that me.
What are your favorite movie books? Books on movies.
Books on movies. Let me I do like Easy Riders, Raging Bulls. Let's see, what else do I like? The Kid Stays in the Picture by Robert Evans. City of Nets by Otto Friedrich, which is about old Hollywood, which is an awesome book.
City of Nets?
City of Nets. It's one of the most famous books. It was written a long time ago, but it's all about like the classic Hollywood. He was a famous author. Empire of Their Own I like a lot. What else? Help me out here. Hey, I like that book on Warren Oates a lot.
Yes, me too.
I do. I really do love that book. I mean,
it's a great topic. Great topic.
Yeah, it's a great topic. There's a biography of Peckinpah I love by David Weddell. Is They Move, Kill Them? That's a great book. I mean, there's a lot of them, and obviously all the David Thompson books. I have a lot of coffee table books that I love. That I have tons of coffee table books that I just love, like poster books and things like that. But, yeah, I mean, I could just name some, please, because Roger Ebert's books are the great movies.
Yeah. Well, Darren Aronofsky listed his favorite film books.
Okay.
And they are Making Movies by Sidney Lumet.
Great book.
He says, it's an incredibly clear, honest, and precise discussion of the films Lumet made over the course of his career, pearls of wisdom about directing and filmmaking, breaks down all the different problems. He said he learned a lot from that. An author that we've had on the show, Christopher Vogler, The Writer's Journey, Aronofsky claims it's the Bible for screenwriters. It's the best book on how to write a screenplay, and it helped him get through many roadblocks.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Easy Riders, Raging Bulls.
Mm-hmm.
Is on there. The Ragman's Son, Kirk Douglas's.
Oh, Kirk Douglas's, yeah.
Autobiography. And of course, the most famous film book of all, Hitchcock Truffaut.
Oh.
I mean, you always see that
mentioned. Another great one is on William Goldman's Adventures in the Screen Trade. That's an awesome book.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love, and he has another one that he wrote long after that, Which Lie Do I Tell Next, which is very good.
Well, we'll be covering some film books as well throughout this month and next with a series of interviews. There's an interesting book called Bite Size Television by Ross Brown. We'll be welcoming all these authors on the show. And Bite Size Television is actually... You see more and more professional filmmakers doing this, too. They're going into making webisodes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a great venue for amateur filmmakers, student filmmakers, to start their own TV series on the web.
Mm-hmm.
And this book deals with the A to Z of how you do that, from constructing a story that works in a multi-episode manner to producing it, and then finally to making it profitable. So we'll be discussing that with Ross later on this month. Illuminations, Memorable Movie Moments. This is written by Richard Pepperman, and it talks about all the seminal movie moments that helped to shape his life. And by writing about this, I mean, he kind of establishes a kinship with everyone that loves movies and reminds the reader of what's so powerful and effective about these great movie moments in our own lives. Penn Densham, who is the screenwriter of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and the writer-director of Moll Flanders, he's written a book about screenwriting called Writing the Alligator, Strategies for a Career in Screenplay Writing. That's really, really very good. And then we talk about production and a new book called Casting Revealed by Hester Schell. Tells you everything you need to know about casting. If you're an independent filmmaker and you're worried about that process of finding the best actors and how to work with them, this is a real eye-opening book. And you know, it's interesting how headshots for actors out there, I mean, headshots are really more and more a thing of the past, I think.
Right, yeah.
With the advent of, you know, video, that's well within the reach of anyone to post online. I mean, any actor worth their weight will have a reel to show or be able to videotape an audition and submit it. And it gives you such a clear indication of what they're capable of than just a headshot, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I found some more. I'm in the library now. 5001 Nights at the Movies by Pauline Kael, and I Lost It at the Movies. Got to have those. Robert Rodriguez's Rebel Without a Crew. Awesome, awesome book. And you can't forget the John Gregory Dunn's The Studio and Monster. Those books are just incredible. I mean, eye-opening books, especially Monster. It's just an eye-opening book about Hollywood. Those are a couple. I mean, there are more, but those are the other ones I forgot to mention.
Do you have a big library?
Well, I mean, just all over the house. I have books all over the house, and those are just a couple. I mean, there are others. I mean, I have a lot. There are a lot of great books, like in the mid and late 90s that came out about independent film. There's one, Donald Lyons, Independent Visions, which is awesome. I remember reading that. But God, that must have been, like, I think it's 93 or 94. And then there's one, Cinema of Outsiders, that came out, I think,
right,
in 99. That's a great book.
Is that the Cinema of Outsiders?
I think so. It's down in the basement. I'd have to go look for it later.
Because there's that great Robert Kolker book called The Cinema of Loneliness.
That's an incredible book.
Yeah.
With Travis Bickle
on
the cover, right? That's the one with great book, yeah.
And then there's a new book about how to be a production assistant, which is interesting. This guy, Joshua Friedman, he goes from film set to film set. I mean, from...
That's a really awesome book to have.
Yeah.
Right.
That's so
important.
He's been on film sets like The Adjustment Bureau and The Beaver and Salt, and he goes every step of what to expect. I mean, the production assistants are just invaluable on the film set, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a new book we'll be talking about in the future weeks on the show. The Woman in the Story by Helen Jacy. This is about how to craft effective female characters, which is a big challenge for a lot of male writers out there that can't understand females in their own lives. And a great new book called The Film That Changed My Life. It's actually a series of interviews with 30 directors who talk about the movies that made them want to be filmmakers, that affected them the most. And, you know, somebody like John Dahl discusses A Clockwork Orange, and John Woo discusses Rebel Without a Cause, and it's a great book.
That reminds me of that series of those two volumes. I only read the first volume. I have the second volume, too, though, and it's called My First Movie, and I interview a director about their first film. That's an awesome. Those are awesome books.
Yeah, the Coen brothers were interviewed as part of that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that book. All of these books are available for purchase if you go to moviegeeksunited.net/media. You can purchase the books there. And we'll be talking about the latest in DVDs and Blu-rays and some new soundtracks, too. Here's an interesting story in the show. Here's an interesting story. A Florida teen has admitted to police that bite marks on her body came from Twilight-inspired vampire role-playing.
Wow.
Not from someone who attacked her while she was out jogging. The South Florida Sun-Sentinel reports that the Monroe County Sheriff's Office has charged the 15-year-old girl with making a false report. Authorities say the girl is a fan of the Twilight movies and books, and she engaged in fantasy biting with a 19-year-old man in August and worried that her mother would see the marks, so she later told her mother that she had been attacked while jogging. She eventually revealed what really happened when deputies couldn't find evidence of the attack.
Wow.
No charges filed against the 19-year-old man.
Wow.
It's okay,
to
bite someone. Just don't lie about it.
Yeah, really.
That's the moral of this story.
Wow.
Do you,
Twilight.
Which
is so powerful.
Yeah. That heavily influences me not to go to the movies. But do you think there's a link between film and, you know, behavior like that, especially among the impressionable youth?
I think kids trying to, you know, kids always want attention, and we're all kids. I think that's what it has to do. I think it is a very slippery slope because if you do say that, what about for some of the more like action-oriented films that someone will say, oh, they watched, remember the Virginia Tech thing? They wanted to pin that on Old Boy, remember? Because of that photo of the guy who did the shooting. There's a photo of him with the hammer in an exact pose, like from Old Boy. And that was a mini controversy that started after that horrible tragedy. Obviously, for something of such a phenomenon like Twilight, yeah, I do see a lot of that, its whole subculture, if you will. I mean, it's bound to happen, but I don't know if I want to see a direct link. Because what about all the other people that watch it or read it and they don't act out? There's always, I guess, a couple rotten apples, I guess. I don't know. But bite marks, I mean, oh, God, what's next?
Well, what will they be inspired to do after leaving the Justin Bieber movie?
Oh, God. You're really obsessed with this. I'm sorry I didn't go see it.
I mean, adults would be inspired to commit suicide, but what about... actually, my friend has, like, 4 children, and they're all girls, and, man, they went to the Justin Bieber movie the other night, and they were just beside themselves about it.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, so it's the greatest movie ever.
Oh, well, I'm sure. When we went to go see Tangled, we took my niece to see Tangled, and they showed that trailer for the Justin Bieber movie, and she was kind of, she's 10 years old, and she was just, like, really dumbfounded that they would make a movie already about him. Because how old is he? Like, what, 8, 16, 17? How old is he?
I think he's 16 now.
And this is like a biography movie on him? I mean, forgive me, but is there... I mean, obviously there's a demand for it, obviously, judging from the numbers this weekend. And
look, and it's the best reviewed movie out this weekend.
That's not hard to do. You know, that's what we're doing. You don't have to set the bar that high.
Well, look, this guy, I don't know his name off the top of my head, but this guy actually directed Step Up 3D, was his last movie. And then he does the Justin Bieber 3D movie, Never Say Never. And both of them got surprisingly good reviews. So I think this guy's strategy is... take a property that no one expects anything from.
Right.
And when you make it halfway decent, people will say, oh, my God, that didn't suck. And they'll praise it even more than they would have if they had expectations that it would have been halfway decent.
True. That's actually, okay, I understand what you're saying.
But also, I mean, they say that this is excellent 3D in his Step Up 3D. Like, I've heard several critics say this is the best use of 3D.
Not Piranha? Not Jackass?
No.
Not that horrible Wes Craven movie, which I'm still trying to figure out what was in 3D.
Oh, My Soul to Take.
Oh, my God, dude. I'm watching this. I'm like, what's in 3D? What the hell is in 3D in this?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is a great film, but this is like one of those, if I had kids, I guess I'd go see The Eagle and let them go see Justin Bieber.
Yeah. Well, it came in second place, Bieber did, in 400 fewer theaters than the number one film, which was the Adam Sandler movie, Just Go With It. So a really healthy weekend, I think.
This is the first good weekend in a while that they've had.
Adam Sandler did $31 million. Bieber did $30.2 million. Gnomeo and Juliet did 25.5, and The Eagle 8.5. That's the top 4 films. So pretty good weekend all around.
Yeah.
Did you see the Sandler movie?
Yes, I did. I did see.
You
the
did? Film. Okay.
Yeah.
This is the one that Nicole Kidman makes an appearance.
Yeah,
in.
She's in it. Jennifer
that.
Aniston's in it, obviously, but I wanted to actually start off the show that maybe we should do like a career retrospective of Dennis Dugan.
Oh, did he direct this?
Yes.
Okay.
I think this should be a whole thing. Adam Sandler likes to give his friends work, and this film is no exception.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I really guess we're never going to see another Punch Drunk Love. We're just never going to see that.
You know, and Sandler seems to apologize for those kinds of films that he does. He says, yeah, I know, it's not my fans' cup of tea. I'll go back to doing the other stuff. he almost seems apologetic about doing a Rain Over Me or Punch Drunk Love or you know, any of those other kinds of films where he branches out, which he's completely capable of. But I, in reading reviews of Just Go With It, I've heard that it's really Jennifer Aniston's movie.
It is. It really is. It's hers. And it's, and actually, she's not bad in it. And, you know, it's not a, not a, I mean, it's not like something like some of the other previous Sandler movies. But going back to that, it's interesting. And you have someone like Jim Carrey who keeps every couple of films to go outside the box big time with, like, I Love You, Philip Morris. And,
right.
And it's really nice to see him, like, try to do something different. I wish that Sandler would do that more often. We know he can do this. I mean, he's done it. It seems like...
You can do it!
You can do it, exactly. There's the Water Boy, sure. It's, you know, we know he can do it. But, yeah, it is Jennifer Aniston's movie. But you've seen Nicole Kidman in this. It's just like, wow, what's she doing in here?
Have you? Did you get the new Vanity Fair Hollywood issue?
Yes, I haven't gotten a chance to look through it yet, but we did get it, and it's so. I mean, that's an awesome front cover though, with all those with all the actors and actresses on it. And there's some supposedly there's a great article supposedly on Thelma and Louise, and I think there's also something on Mel Gibson in there.
Yeah, Peter Biskin writes about Mel Gibson. I read that article. Peter Biskin is pretty cruel about. Imagine that. About Gibson's talent as a director. He's like, no one would call Mel Gibson a great director by any stretch of the imagination. I'm like, really? I think he's pretty great as a filmmaker, you know?
Regardless of what you think of the subject matter of the four films, and they're four very different films. They're all linked if you want to do with some sort of, obviously, he is into, when especially when he's directing himself, there is with The Man Without a Face and Braveheart. He does like to inflict pain on himself in various ways, but they are actually four very interesting films.
Mm-hmm.
I think all, I mean, regardless, they're beautiful, all of them beautifully shot.
Very visceral. I mean,
yeah,
he's a very visceral filmmaker.
I think that's just, that's just a really ignorant thing to say.
I think so too, but it kind of, the article goes into the dichotomy of the man. I mean, how so many people love him and have nothing but great things to say based on their experiences with him, and then others, you know, take a different stance on him. And this all of this stuff just seemed to pop up out of nowhere for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
With his arrest, like Mel Gibson, they didn't know. But and it does ask the question of, you know, where does he go from here? And the review that he gives on The Beaver, which I guess he's seen in relation to this article, because Jodie Foster takes part in this article, is very positive.
Okay.
But they say, but he says not a commercial movie. I mean, it's an art house kind of movie. But it's very autobiographical for Mel Gibson. And there's something about he's always avenging his father.
In the movies?
Yes. Avenging the honor of the father or the son or something. There's always that father-son connection in his films. Like... film after film that he does, and Biskin makes that point very, very vividly in the book, in the article that he writes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look no further than Hamlet. I mean, Hamlet seemed like a detour, but in the terms of the themes that Mel Gibson's always dealt with,
the Patriot,
it fit
too.
Right in there. Yeah. Oh, he goes on and on there. I gotta look that up to go through all the movies he talks about, but and then there's a good article about Harvey Weinstein too, and how he got his groove back.
Oh, dude, big time! I mean,
yeah,
it's unbelievable. But that's not unbelievable. Someone like that, it's just a lot of people were quick to write off the Weinstein Company because they weren't their first couple of years weren't that good. And I would say he, after last summer with Inglourious Bastards and everything, he really. They really found their thing last summer and last year and this year with the King's Speech. I mean, dude, he's back. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I would never pull him out.
He's regained his love of making movies because apparently when he started the Weinstein Company and he made flop after flop, he didn't want to make movies. He had kind of soured on the experience of that. And so he said he finally, in about 2007, learned to love to make movies again. And that's been the reason for his uptick, you know.
Okay.
He's behind Company Men, behind The Fighter, behind King's Speech. So he's a major player. He's never not been.
Right.
But, yeah.
Did you see The Company Men?
No, it hasn't come anywhere near here.
Okay, yeah. It's really, I mean, okay, it's like my mom and I would just go see all these bleak movies. I mean, they're all bleak, but it's an exceptionally well-done movie. All the performances are really outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
Really, especially Tommy Lee Jones. And I think we missed the Tommy Lee Jones movie last night. I'll watch it on demand when I get a chance.
Oh, did it air last night on HBO?
Yeah, it did. He was very funny. I read an interview with him, and he said something. No, they asked him about Men in Black 3. I have no idea what this is about. Most parts of the film have not been written yet. And then they asked him about Captain America, and he's like, I have no idea why I'm in Captain America. I keep asking myself that every day. It was hilarious.
I was thinking about Tommy Lee Jones. Tommy Lee Jones has to be the one interview I never want to do. He's got to be
intimidating. I mean,
the toughest interview.
Mm-hmm.
Because he hates it. He will make fun of you for the questions you ask.
Oh, I am sure. I mean, just from what I've read, but he just doesn't want to be there.
He'll like stick to one syllable answers, and yeah, it's tough. Is there one person you would not want to interview?
Well, there are people. I mean, that I'd be intimidated by that, like because of that reputation, that kind of reputation. Yeah, I mean, Tommy Lee Jones is definitely one of them. But I'd be like nervous. I'd be really just nervous interviewing people I admire greatly because you don't want to come off like a fawning idiot. But Tommy Lee Jones definitely. I think I'd be really. We interviewed those some of the hardest people to interview though.
Yeah.
Intimidating figures. I mean, Paul Schrader and Brian De Palma. And Paul Schrader, I was the most nervous about because he's so smart and so. I had no idea what to expect from him. De Palma scared the hell out of me, too. I mean, he did, dude. I was so nervous that night, that Wednesday night, the whole day, just like just shaking constantly.
Yeah.
But we've done a really good job so far. But definitely Tommy Lee Jones. I would say Tarantino. I'd be petrified of.
Mm-hmm.
I want to interview him, but I'd be scared shitless.
I'm only if I get nervous anymore. I only get nervous before I pick up the phone and say
mm-hmm.
hi to them.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Because if they're worth anything in an interview, then automatically you're at ease when they're
mm-hmm.
when they turn out to be conversational.
Exactly.
And I think that Tarantino would be, I mean, there'd be no work involved in that.
No. I mean, but you want something like with him. I mean, yeah, I mean, obviously no work. I mean, you get him rolling and boom. That's awesome.
Pacino would be it for me.
Oh, yeah, I mean.
I mean, Coppola, you and I were both nervous before we talked to him.
But he was very, very,
very kind and
very
generous.
Kind. And same with James Cameron. James Cameron was very kind.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. All right. We should be talking about
dude,
all our feelings about our interview.
Dude, we talked to some quite, you know.
We talked to James Cameron, man. I mean.
We started this 4 years ago, April.
Mm-hmm.
So our anniversary's coming up. We've accomplished something.
Oh, we've accomplished a lot, David. We should be very proud of what we've done in a short amount of time. Oh, are you going to play, let me guess, for the anniversary show, are you going to play the Spanking the Monkey sound clip repeatedly throughout the show?
Why would I wait for that?
Spanking the Monkey. I think Spanking the Monkey is very bold.
I can't wait till we interview David O. Russell. You can play
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. That's all I want you to say. My co-host Jerry is here with us, Mr. Russell. Spanking the Monkey is very bold. That's what I'll do. You will kill me.
No, that'd be
fun. I would do that. Hey, Aaron's on the line.
Oh, cool.
I just saw Aaron.
Hey, guys, what's up?
Hey, how are
what's
you doing,
up?
Aaron?
I'm pretty good. Hanging out.
Cool.
How are y'all doing?
Good.
Gary, how's the weather?
The weather's a lot nicer. It's warming up here, so thank you. It's no, we don't have any snow, thankfully, and the power's on, knock on wood, so.
Hey. Be thankful for small miracles.
That's right. That's absolutely.
Here's one more movie story before we get into the DVD releases. You hear this Die Hard 5 thing? This Die Hard 5 story now?
Mm-hmm.
So Die Hard 5 is happening. Bruce Willis is involved. Die Hard 5 just chose its director. I could see Len Wiseman for the fourth one because
mm-hmm.
he is with the Underworld movies. He has a history in the action genre. But Noam Murrow,
yeah.
Is the director of this. His previous credit is the movie Smart People.
It's
not something you would equate with with the job
when
played.
I saw Smart People, that's all I could think of. Like, this guy would direct a great Die Hard movie. No, I saw that when you posted that on. You were talking to Chris or something, and I saw that. I was like, what? And of
yes.
course, I was just like, I mean, I'm all for branching out and doing, you know, stepping outside your comfort zone, but Smart People?
He must have had a great pitch. I mean,
yeah.
He must have gone into the studio with his idea of what he can make this movie, and they were most impressed by his presentation. I mean, we don't know, and we talked about it last week. We don't know what people are capable of if they're not given the opportunity.
That's right. You're right about that. And I also
God bless him.
Economics, too, though. They get this guy they don't have to pay him a lot, so that's another.
That might be it.
That's probably the main reason. But no, I'm sure I would be very. I'm just curious. Does anyone know what the storyline is? Or
I know that John McClane wants to make it an international story. I think.
Okay.
So
aren't
he doesn't
all,
want to. Go ahead.
Aren't like at least a couple of the diehards, like 2 and 3, weren't? I mean, aren't they all in a way international, even though they take place in obviously in the U.S. But I mean, like all the villains are like. Corner.
Right.
That's a good point, Aaron, yeah.
It's like the 24 thing, where Kiefer Sutherland wants to take 24 to London or something. You know, he doesn't want to be stuck in a city during a certain time period, which all the diehards are kind of built upon that.
Mm-hmm.
Except
for the last one, which was more about, like, the Eastern Seaboard, which is why I thought it was terrible. Mm. I'm not really hey, I'm all for directors getting the chance. I'm glad that the director of, you know, for instance, 500 Days of Summer is doing the new Spider-Man. I think that's going to be fun. Really, all I care about is Die Hard getting its bite back, you know, non-PG-13 neutering. So,
now, let me ask you this. Do you think they'll do that? Do you think they'll go with the R-rated? Or do you think because they were able to make, for given the film and everything, a lot of money, that they might stay on the PG-13 route?
I mean, I would love for them to do R, but I wouldn't be shocked if they spec
right.
out with the PG-13. It wouldn't surprise me at this point. You know, it occurred to me, I had this revelation, it's not a major one, but a few weeks ago, you know, when PG-13 came out, it was because people saw so much intense stuff was going into PG,
mm-hmm.
and so PG-13 came out. And so, you know, us as kids, when we saw a movie was PG-13, we got excited because we knew it was going to be a little harder than a PG film.
Right.
Now it seems, now the reverse has happened to PG-13. It's like PG-13 is now the new PG. It's like, you know, I'm wondering if they should tally up how many films actually get rated PG in a year versus... You know, it's like
right.
it goes to G to PG-13. Like, no one even bothers with PG anymore.
And there's some R-rated films. I mean, there's some R-rated films. Like, I rewatched Paranormal Activity 2 last week, which I still think is a really effective
mm-hmm.
movie. And I think that was rated R because there were too many F-bombs in it.
In intensity.
Yeah.
Well, the same thing with The King's Speech. The King's Speech... If they had rated The King's Speech PG-13 originally, no parent Christian group would have raised an eyebrow. I'm almost certain of that. Even with the language, no one would have noticed because it's a feel good movie. It has a good
mm-hmm.
lesson and all that stuff. No one would have noticed that it was a PG-13 movie.
Mm-hmm.
That film should have been PG-13 from the get go. So,
but you know that they count the F word.
I know. They're a weird thing. Sometimes they're bean counters, sometimes they're not. I mean, obviously they're bean counters with how many F words they can have in a film. But then you go to something like Black Swan versus Blue Valentine, and they get uncomfortable with it, but basically they're more or less the same sex, the same acts,
mm-hmm.
almost photographed the same way. It's just one is in a high camp film that you don't take seriously, and one is in a film that is totally serious and you're made uncomfortable. So they're not bean counters when it comes to sexuality. They're, you know, they do let their emotions dictate ratings.
Right.
There's an interesting thing on the new Kevin Smith. You know, he videotapes his speaking engagements or something.
Mm-hmm.
Something that he came out with. It's on Netflix called Too Fat to Fly, which is another one of those where he talks to college, university or something.
Right.
And he's telling a story about Cop Out and working with Bruce Willis and why they didn't get along. And apparently he was setting up a shot or something, and Bruce Willis said, "What kind of lens are you going to use here?" And Kevin Smith says, "What kind of lens?" He says, "Well, I don't have any idea. That's my DP's job." And Bruce Willis said, "You don't know what kind of lens you're going to use here?" He says, "I know the lenses. Why wouldn't you know the lenses?" What do you think of that?
I'm kind of shocked in one sense that you...
I'm kind of shocked that Bruce Willis knows lenses.
I'm shocked that you would, as a director, though, as someone who is, you know, I think it was on this show we talked about Kevin Smith, and it was probably with Dean that we talked about Kevin Smith, I think, a couple of weeks ago, but I would have thought that Kevin Smith would know about lenses and things like that, just because I think you would admit that. Do you think he was just pulling his leg or something? Or?
No, I don't. He was being serious. You know, when you're first starting out, I mean, you depend upon your DP
for
guidance all the time, no matter what stage you are in a career. But when you first start out, of course you don't know that kind of thing. But just the mere fact that Kevin Smith has made so many movies, by process of repetition, you would think that he would figure out the kinds of lenses that he'd need in this scene. Bruce Willis knows the kinds of lenses he needs in a scene because
he has directed a movie.
Directing. Yeah. He is a movie star for a reason. And movie stars who are cognizant of their image, they know, and great actors know this too, how much am I supposed to give in this scene?
Mm-hmm.
And that all depends upon placement of camera and the type of lens that's being used, the level of performance to give in any given shot. He's smart about that.
Right.
But for Kevin Smith not to have any clue at this stage in his career just further illustrates the point that why is he making movies? I mean...
Well, that's an interesting thing, and I don't want to take too much time on this, but I talked about this on this show, and I talked about this with some friends a couple of years ago. After, you know, he was really bummed out that Zach and Marie Make a Porno did not do very well, and I think it was after that that he was really just going to give up on filmmaking, I heard, altogether, and just focus on the podcast and the speaking engagements. I mean, Kevin Smith is, at the time, seemed like he was much more interested in these speaking engagements than the podcast, more than filmmaking. So when it was announced about Red State being made, finally, I was kind of shocked, because I was like, I thought he had really just sort of lost interest in the filmmaking part of his life. I thought that was really over.
I had a friend in Sundance who saw Red State, and I asked him about, you know, how did it look? And he was actually startled that it looked, you know, it was actually innovative visually, and there were some things in there that were kind of surprising that, you know, he couldn't believe it was a Kevin Smith film. So maybe Kevin Smith will never admit it or not, but maybe, you know, even at this late in the game, maybe he finally learned about a lens or two.
Maybe he regretted saying that afterwards, you know, admitting to that. Maybe he felt, well, maybe I should know this. I mean, I have heard mixed things about Red State. I want to see it. I definitely want to see it. But I've heard so many, all over the board about it. But it is different.
You know, and the thing about Cop Out, the thing about just, and I don't want to dwell on Cop Out, it's a bad movie. The thing about Cop Out, one, it remains Kevin Smith's most financially successful film.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about Cop Out, the problem with Cop Out is on a script level. The directing of Cop Out is serviceable to that, is functional to that type of film.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Cop Out was no more or no less polished a piece of filmmaking than, say, Martin Brest's Beverly Hills Cop, you know, which is a film that was obviously kind of emulating and trying
right.
to poke fun at the same time. So, I mean, you know, Kevin Smith, I question when Kevin Smith tries to play the average Joe kind of thing. You know, that worked with Clerks and all the way up to even Dogma. But, you know, when you have your own site and your own brand and you are a brand, you know, you're not an average, whether you know it or not, you're not an average Joe anymore.
You're a brand. As you said, you are a brand. You're absolutely
you're
right.
You're a brand. You know, so, I mean, yeah. So. Anyway, Home Entertainment.
I can't get the chat room open, guys. I've tried all
okay, well, I'm in there with Becky Felix and OSLC. Kirsten was in there earlier. I don't know what
Oh, you're in the chat room. Okay.
I'm in the chat room, yes. And
well, it's
all,
just me. That's good to know. Just the host can't. You know, the one run of the switchboard can't even open the chat room. What's wrong with my computer? Man,
I
need
don't
a
know.
New computer.
Maybe it's not your computer. It could be also the site. You know, you never know. Don't be so quick to blame your computer for this one.
Poor computer. Poor baby.
Poor
sorry I insulted you, computer. I'm petting it now. Hang on.
Oh, God. Okay. Let's get to Home Entertainment. Let's talk about
Home Entertainment.
Criterion.
Okay. Let me talk about some Criterions. And Aaron, you can pipe in here, too. Okay. The latest Criterion releases, we talked about two of these titles a little bit. Show earlier, the two new Sam Fuller titles, Shock Corridor, about a reporter that investigates a murder inside an insane asylum by committing himself to that asylum.
That little bit of Shutter Island.
Yes, that's true, that's true.
It is, yeah.
It comes with a new interview with the star of the film, Constance Towers.
Mm.
And also a 1996 documentary on Mr. Fuller called The Typewriter, The Rifle, and The Movie Camera.
That's a good documentary. I remember watching that. Doesn't Tim Robbins narrate and host it?
Yes, I'll say yes.
Okay.
And, of course, the typical great packaging that Criterion does. Also, The Naked Kiss, the 1964 Sam Fuller film, which also has an interview with Constance Towers and a lot of other episodes or a lot of other features in here, including a 1987 episode of the French television series Cinemas, which features an interview with Fuller. So those are two new Sam Fuller releases from Criterion. And also Broadcast News, which is their great release.
Yeah, what's on the Broadcast News?
Broadcast News has a great commentary by Brooks, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the alternate, not so much alternate, but the different ending that Brooks decided not to go with, which is fascinating on its own. I just want to go back and say that The Naked Kiss, if I'm not mistaken, Jamie, that is the working title of your autobiography.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Okay. All right.
I don't know how to follow that up. Broadcast News, yeah, and that alternate ending, or that original ending that they include, and it's interesting because it's all kind of it's a single shot in the back of a taxi cab when she leaves the airport. And I guess it just didn't play. It didn't get the right level of bittersweet that he was looking for, I think. But he does great commentary on it. It also has a great documentary on it, featuring an interview with you know, a lot of James Brooks's collaborators and the original inspiration for Holly Hunter's character.
Right. Fine piece of work. Fine piece of work.
Yeah, it's a great DVD. I would highly recommend picking that up. And The Double Life of Ronique. I'm dropping these left and right. I'm trying to go through them. Which is another Criterion release that's available now.
That's a good
one.
I like that movie. I like that.
You do like that film, Jerry?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Krzysztof Kieslowski. One of those rare Dream Logic films that all the connections make sense, and it's not as it's not trying to play games with you. So
mm-hmm.
It really does. It actually, unlike most Dream Logic films, it does have a logic to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then also Fish Tank, which Jerry, you've already established you're crazy about from 2009.
Yeah, I love that film. It really just blew me away. I will buy this on Blu-ray as soon as I think. What is it? February 22nd. Yeah.
Right.
It includes the director's prior three short films.
Oh, cool.
A new video interview with Kirsten Waring. An audio conversation with actor Michael Fassbender is on there.
Fassbender.
He's great. Because like
also audition footage in the
movie. He's a chameleon. He's so different in each role that I've seen him in. It's amazing just how different he is.
Fish Tank, what is the story about Fish Tank?
It's, British working class, but, from this young girl's, teenage girl's point of view, she wants to be a dancer. But it's her life in, I don't know if I want to say it, but in, the British, the work projects.
Lower working class, British.
Yeah, but I don't want to offend anybody, but, I don't want to use the wrong terms, but it just shows you her life, a couple of days in her life, and it's not, and, Jamie, I was just, really taken with it. We watched it on demand. I would have kept it, if possible, for a couple of weeks and watched it every day. I thought it was that good. It was something I had no idea about. The only prior thing I knew about the movie was a guy who sent the email that you forwarded to me telling about the podcast that Michael Fassbender was going to be on because, I liked Inglourious Bastards so much, especially Fassbender, and I remember that, and I was like, okay, Fish Tank. So then I went downstairs, and I was just flipping through the on-demand. I saw it listed, and I was like, okay, we all got to watch this. And I was just like, wow, this is so cool. It really was just unexpectedly moving.
So Fish Tank available through Criterion this month as well. We have a call. Let's take this call. It's I can't tell you the area code because it seems to be an unlisted number. Caller, are you with us? Always a good idea. Okay. Aaron.
Well, let me... So I guess my couple of times, I'm a little more eclectic and not as, I guess, highbrow.
That's all right. We're not high. Right. We're not 100% highbrow here.
But the Blu-ray and the DVD, the Blu-ray I'll speak up for is the recent Blu-ray release of Alice in Wonderland, the 60th anniversary from Disney. Oh. And Disney's been doing really good by their Blu-rays of their classics. This is no exception. Alice in Wonderland, while not, it's not a Snow White or Fantasia, which are greater Blu-rays, the detail quality and the extras are pretty awesome. But I consider this kind of a preamble, curtain raiser to, for me, the Disney release of the season that's coming up in March of Bambi, which is going to come out on Blu-ray, which I think will be spectacular. But until then, Alice in Wonderland is very, very, is no slouch, and it's a terrific transfer. And then on the other spectrum, this is kind of interesting, You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger, the Woody Allen film.
You got that.
Did get that. And I got it on DVD just because, since there are no extras, it didn't seem to warrant the Blu-ray upgrade.
Right.
But, it's funny, Woody Allen is, he's 76 now. And it's interesting it's funny. I was one of the few people who liked the film before this, Whatever Works, and I knew a few critics who said it was one of the worst films that he had done. And then the following year, You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger, I know some of the same critics who didn't like Whatever Works, they thought You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger is one of his best films in a long time.
Really?
So,
people thought it was his best? Okay. One of.
They had it on, I know a few, couple of critics had it on their top 10 list. Our good friend Keith Ulick had it on his top 10 list.
No, it's a decent film. And I don't think Whatever Works is the worst thing he's done. It gets on
my nerves. I think Whatever Works is actually underrated.
Yeah.
What I find interesting at this stage in Woody Allen's career is that I think Woody Allen has kind of, at least for now anyway, post Max Point, he's kind of reached this this stage in late career where each film kind of represents something totally different for whoever views it.
Mm-hmm.
And seems to speak, to me, it seems to speak volumes how said viewer relates to Woody Allen's work in general, particularly in this late stage, you know, this
right.
post, this post Annie Hall, Hannah and her sister's glory days, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So I find the year-to-year reaction to the latest Woody Allen kind of a, I mean, almost akin to, I guess you could say, the, you know, the, in a weird way, the latest Bob Dylan or Elvis Costello album, you know.
That's like, an interesting analogy. That's a good analogy.
You know, if you're a fan at this late stage in the career, you know, you're going to buy the latest Dylan or the latest
mm-hmm.
Costello album,
mm-hmm.
whether or not you've heard it or not, and then you're going to be like, oh, it's minor or major or disappointed, and you're already, I mean, it's like you're on board. There's not going to be, well, I'm not buying this latest Dylan album. You're buying a Dylan album. You know, you're buying, you know, for some people, I mean, you're buying the latest Prince album, no matter
right.
what.
No, that's true. Those are all good points.
Are you referring to me when you say that?
No. I wanted to be in snarky, but it's true. There are these artists, you know, and music is one way, you know, in doing it in a music way, there are these artists where you're going to buy the album no matter what. No matter, you know, it could have the worst
right.
reviews ever.
Right.
You're going to buy it because you want to hear it for yourself. And Woody Allen has kind of reached that point. You're going to go see the Woody Allen film no matter what.
Yeah.
And I find that fascinating about Woody. You know,
do you think
Woody
Allen could tell Bruce Willis which lens he's using on him?
I'm sure he could.
You know, I honestly think maybe, I think Woody Allen probably has a, I say yes. Maybe not, he wouldn't be as detailed as maybe a David Fincher. But, you know, and Woody Allen always likes to say, well, you know, I surround myself with the best people so they can make me look good. But if you look at something like Manhattan, which is all about every shot is a perfectly composed shot, you know, that's not, I mean, obviously a majority of that is Gordon Willis, but, I mean,
mm-hmm.
Woody Allen is saying yay or nay, that shot, that shot, that shot.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say Woody Allen probably does have a rudimentary understanding of lenses, or I'm sure Kurosawa.
Aesthetics. I mean, he lampoons it in Hollywood Ending, getting
mm-hmm.
Vietnamese cinematographer or
yeah.
whatever it is. I mean, he's used different cinematographers throughout his career, and some of his movies have a very special look to them. I mean, Hollywood Ending has a special look to it. It looks
Hollywood Ending
beautiful. Glossy.
Radio Days. Radio
yeah.
Days is very Fellini-esque,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so, yeah, so I think Woody, Akira Kurosawa was blind for, like, the last, you know, from, like, Ron on, you know, he was, like, borderline blind, and I'm pretty sure he had a working knowledge of lenses, even as a blind man, so.
Yes.
I'm sure, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb and say Uwe Boll has a rudimentary working idea of lenses. Now, this doesn't mean...
He's suing.
You know,
Uwe Boll is suing the Berlin Film Festival for charging him a fee to put his movie Auschwitz in consideration.
Right.
And the Berlin Film Festival says this is just, you know, regular protocol. But Uwe Boll's claim is that they give preferential treatment, meaning entry with no fee, or to other filmmakers. Why not him?
I wouldn't be surprised. I'm sure Martin Scorsese probably gets a waiver on the fee,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, that's Martin Scorsese, and this is Uwe Boll. And
yeah.
as I said, I'm pretty sure he has a rudimentary knowledge of lenses. That doesn't mean he actually knows how to use the lenses.
That's going to be our new barometer for if a director is worth his weight.
Every director from now on, no matter what, new or old, we should say, do you know lenses?
It's going to backfire horribly.
They know lenses. Yes or no?
A new Elia Kazan title is available now on DVD as well. America, America. Actually, it's part of
a great movie.
Yeah, part of that box set from. You can buy it separately too.
Right.
There's
but
the Elia Kazan box set.
Yeah, this is it's part of the Elia Kazan box set, and also I think it also falls under the Warner Archives heading. So, yeah, America. I saw this as a, oddly enough, I saw this like when I was 13, 14, when I was going, oddly enough, I was going through my Ilya Kazan phase. This was right after
Who can forget their 13-year-old Ilya Kazan phase?
Hey, this was right after my John Carpenter phase.
That's quite a jump. That's quite a...
You'd be surprised how smooth the transition was.
I like that. That's neat.
Yeah. So America, very autobiographical film. Not an easy film to watch. It is quite demanding, but it is rewarding in the long run. It's probably his most personal film for him. Doesn't mean probably his best film, but it is his most personal. I would still go with. I have a soft spot for Tree Grows in Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
which is also in that box set. But yeah, I mean, the Warner Archive. You know, Jamie, we got to talking about Home and the Team. One of these days, we got to plan a show and get a couple of the heads in charge of these on manufactured on demand
mm-hmm,
guys
mm-hmm.
talk about this because this truly is the new. One of the biggest explosions that's happened in DVD.
It's a good idea, right?
Yeah. I mean, to the point,
your opinion is it's a good idea? That's what I was asking.
Yes, I do think it's a good idea. And it's just the way the market is planning. Stores are not willing to, they have a limited amount of shelf space. They're
mm-hmm.
not willing to stock the Alice Faye collection number 2. Versus the Ultimate Matrix collection. They're just not going to do it.
One of the biggies, Best Buy, cut down their DVD sales in store recently. And I think you're right. I mean, these are specialty titles that would be of interest to certain factions of film fans.
Mm-hmm.
But not so much interest that they would mass produce them, the titles. So
and
I think it's wonderful that they're making these available. They make them when you order them, made to order.
And it is interesting, things that are falling under this kind of on-demand manufacturing. I mean, I can't remember, it was 4 recent Vincent Minnelli films became part of the Warner Archives, stuff like P for Sympathy and a couple other big films. And I was talking to a critic friend of mine, about 3-4 years ago, it would have been a no-brainer to have a Vincent Minnelli box set, have 4 Vincent Minnelli classics, for $60. But now it's gone to this kind of specialty on-demand thing, and that's kind of fascinating. That's one fascinating thing about this. And the other fascinating thing is that, I've heard statements released to support this, that they've actually, the people who run these departments have been surprised when they put out certain titles that they may say, let's just put this out there, and it turns out to be one of their top 10 sellers, be it whether it's a cult TV movie or an 80s comedy. And I know a lot of people who have bought stuff like using Warner's as an example, stuff like Feds and the All Nighter, these 80s comedy movies, and they've been
Feds. That's that Rebecca De Mornay thing, isn't it?
Yeah. And people, they've been big sellers. Same thing with the TV movies, be it Bad Ronald or Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. And
didn't they
do
the Deliberate Stranger too? Wasn't that released?
Yes,
in fashion?
The Ted Bundy Mark Harmon film. Yes, and
yeah, that's
I'm
good.
It is good. And so there is a market for it. There is a TV movie I'm waiting for. Gary, I don't know if you remember this one. Do you remember back in like 86 to 88, the NBC Monday night movie, Playing with Fire with Gary Coleman?
Yes, I do. I thought you were going to bring up The Burning Bed, but I remember this one too. So, yeah, all right. Yeah.
Playing with Fire with Gary Coleman.
Oh, my God,
yeah.
Gary Coleman. May he rest in peace. Yeah, I do remember that.
This was a Monday night movie for NBC, and he played this troubled kid. And Cicely Tyson with his mother. I can't remember who played his father. It might have been Ron O'Neill, I can't remember. And the family was going through a lot of problems. Parents were fighting, and he was kind of this toying with being a pyromaniac. He was so angry he burned the house down, and his sister accidentally died from inhalation.
It happens to all of us. Did you ever go through a pyromaniac phase?
I think
everyone has gone through some fascination with fire, you know, playing, you know, after, but well, thankfully nothing bad happened.
Well, after the movie ended, Gary Coleman came on and said, you know, hey kid, this is just a movie, do not play with fire, and if you are thinking about it, please call this number. And I pray if they make this a Warner Archives movie manufacturer on demand, that they put on that coda on the DVD. So
that remember that TV movie, Something About Amelia?
Yes, I remember that. Was Ted Danson in that?
Ted Danson as the pedophile, yeah.
Yeah, oh my God, we're bringing up all these. Oh God.
No, I mean, that was like dealing with pedophilia in primetime television.
Yeah, that was a big deal.
I mean, that
back
was a major
then
thing, yeah.
It was him and Glenn Close, and I believe that is part of the Warner Archives.
What about an early Frost?
Close played the young boy that he molested, right? Wasn't it?
Yes, she did. She played the young boy.
Glenn really close.
Did anyone remember Death of a Centerfold with Jamie Lee Curtis?
Yeah, the Dorothy Stratton. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Another classic.
Like starting
so have a
really
TV movie episode. Just talk about our favorite movies of the week.
Man, I watched Star 80 again last night. Well, part of Star 80 again last night. Eric Roberts was one committed dude. You could feel it in that movie.
It's one of the, to me, I've said it before, it's one of the great towering performances of the 80s. It is one of those great performances. One of those benchmarks you can that probably get measured by. You know, so early 80s performance.
Anchor Bay released Let Me In, both versions of I Spit in Your Grave, which we've done special shows for both.
Right.
As well as Jack Goes Boating, the new Philip Seymour Hoffman directed and starring.
Yeah,
movie.
He directed. That was his directorial debut, right? Because his brother Gordy did Love Lisa.
Right.
Yeah,
I like Jack Goes Boating.
I may be the only one, but I liked it.
Well, I heard it, unlike his last film, Synecdoche, New York, it actually had a story.
Oh, God. I
it's based on a play, right? It's based on a play that he did.
I think, I think you're right.
Yeah.
It's a nice little movie.
From Sony, and one of these titles, Aaron, I'm sure you want to talk about. From Sony, we have The Tillman Story, documentary about the famed football player that lost his life in the war.
That's a great documentary.
It's uncomfortable, man.
It is. Very uncomfortable.
That scene at the funeral service where the brother gets up and very uncomfortable. And Nowhere Boy, the story of the young John Lennon, which, Aaron, you've been raving to me about.
Yeah,
I like
number,
that. That was good.
This was number 3 on my top 10 list.
Thank you, Aaron. Because Dean just chided me for liking that. But okay, thank you. Good.
I think it's, as I mentioned in my write-up on it for my top 10 ones, I found it's almost nearly cathartic.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the best portrayals of young adolescent males' discovery of both rock and roll and girls, which seem to happen almost at the same time when you discover both rock and roll and girls. And Nowhere Boy probably gets that better almost than any film I can think of. The only other film that I can compare it to is the early scenes of Almost Famous, which is also similar.
Yeah.
And Nowhere Boy, and Aaron Johnson, who plays the young John Lennon, has more charisma, vulnerability, and humor in any one scene of Nowhere Boy than he did in all of Kick-Ass. And it's a remarkable film. It really is remarkable.
I agree with you. It was very well done. I really enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah, and I mean, in a better year or a lesser year, and if the film had had a little more push, one of or both of the women who played Aunt Mimi and his mother, Julia, would be supporting actress nominated.
Kirsten Scott Thomas, right?
Right.
She was wonderful. I think she's an incredible actress, and I don't think she gets her due at all, but she's a really versatile actress, and
she's
great
in the film. Mm-hmm. She's amazing in the film, and like I said, in a lesser, yes, in a better year, those performances probably would have gotten more traction, but it just didn't work out that way. Yes, Kristen Schott Thomas has now finally redeemed herself for being an
Under the Cherry Moon. Wow.
You knew where
it
I was
took
going
this
with
long.
That, right?
It took this long. I mean, English Patient didn't do it. It took this level of effort to get over that hump.
Yes. I mean, 25 years.
Well,
so what other titles do you need to speak about?
Well, I'll just mention this as far as on the kind of the fringe TV front, which is interesting. Season one of, you'll like this, of Highway to Heaven. The Michael Landon show.
Yes.
And that is interesting. I mean, once again, you know, TV is kind of, I've always said, is the thing that really, one of the things that really made DVD what it is. And so, along with that, you know, couple that with, you know, season two of Nurse Jackie and season six of Weeds that have just, you know, that are going to be coming out in about a week or two, you know, so, you know, TV is still the cat's meow as far as DVD.
Mm-hmm. Well, Weeds has quite a life.
Big life, yeah.
Big life. And Nurse Jackie is a show that's really grown on me. Season two, I think, was very, very, very good. And like I said, you know, I bring up Highway to Heaven just as a segue, but it is interesting, you know, it is an interesting show or artifact of the 80s in that I honestly think, you know, people talk about, you know, stuff like Touched by an Angel or something, but unlike Touched by an Angel, Highway to Heaven was very specific about its Christianity, God, and so forth. And I almost think you couldn't get away with that on a primetime network show today.
Right.
They would want to make it a little more secularist, like it Touched by an Angel.
Which is a shame or not?
I'm of the mind, I'm not a Christian fundamentalist. I'm a Catholic and all that. But I find some of that missing on TV a little... I'm a little torn, and it's funny, you know, in another sense, you know, I was talking to a friend about the TV show Good Times, of all things, you know, and Good Times was an all-African-American sitcom, the first all-African-American sitcom, and this was a family, and it depicted a family that grew up in the project that was trying to make ends meet,
mm-hmm.
and that was a God-fearing family that prayed at dinner and so forth, and it was a great show, and I don't think you could get away with some of that imagery today, and I find that a little sad. Oddly enough, the only show, really, that has church-going families, images, and faith-based images is The Simpsons.
Hmm.
You're right. You're actually right about that.
Wow, well, and the last show where they tried to deal with Christianity and God, but albeit in a very brave way, was the Book of Daniel, and that got axed.
Mm-hmm.
That got
the
axed.
Aidan Quinn.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the priest, the show about the priest on ABC, Nothing Sacred, was another terrific show with Kevin Anderson. You know, so it's funny. You know, I kind of think if you had some of this on a program every now and then, and not doing it in a secularist fashion and actually be a little more specific, I actually think it might actually be a little healthy and a little more, it would definitely make TV more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you think back of the 80s and all the family type shows like Highway to Heaven and what is that one show, Fly Away Home? Or
I'll Fly Away.
Yeah. Deidre Hall and Wilford Brimley. I mean, what's more wholesome than Wilford Brimley? When you wake up and you got your oatmeal right there. I mean, come on.
Father Dowling Mysteries.
Yes.
And Diagnosis Murder. Oh, wait,
and now we're living at such a cynical age, people will be like, don't sell me that propaganda shit.
Yeah, you're right, though.
That wholesome crap, you know. But you can't shove an ideology down people's throats, but there's very few wholesome, you know, shows on
shows.
TV.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Except
TV is claimed now for pushing the limits, the barriers.
Yeah, I mean, look at Skins. I mean,
yeah, Yeah. Classic DVDs out that have been given the Blu-ray treatment. All About Eve and An Affair to Remember are now available on Blu-ray.
Yeah, that All About Eve transfer is spectacular. One of the great black and white films of all time.
And you mentioned Glee, Jerry. Glee Season 2, Part 1.
All right. There we go.
It's also available. That'll be under your Christmas present next
year.
That
will be. Thank you. Awesome. I can't. No, dude, I like Glee, so I haven't watched it in a couple of weeks, but I like it.
And the complete series of Dark Skies is also available, which is this release that's been widely anticipated by a great many fans of the show that's reached cult status now.
Yep.
Wow. Well, how long? Was that in the 90s? The mid, late 90s, Dark Skies?
Yes.
Wow.
It was during that whole Prophet kind of era. Remember
the post X-Files. Everyone trying to do their own X-Files. Yeah, I remember that,
Are we ready to talk film music?
I'm not, but because I'm going to have to bail out of the home entertainment section after with this. But, Jamie, you know where I'm at. So,
yes.
I'm going to bail out. So
You're doing some investigative reporting in an insane asylum.
I'm doing the first investigative piece of journalism for the Huffington Post. It's going to be a big deal.
All right.
They decided to go into the news gathering business. Anyways,
all right.
Jerry.
Well, we enjoyed.
All right, man. Hey, it was awesome to talk to you, man. Thank you for joining us tonight, Aaron.
All right, you be cool, guys.
Yeah, you too.
You too, man.
Bye.
Dude.
Bye.
All right, thank you, Aaron, for joining us. I have no idea what's been going on in the chat room. I'm usually able to be in there.
We have Becky and Deborah, OSLC, Kirsten was here earlier, but we're talking about the Amanda Knox movie. That's where it's gotten to.
Wow. I'm usually able to go in there and start some trouble and start flirting. I haven't been able to do that tonight. I apologize for that. Okay, there's some film soundtracks. We cover film soundtracks every single show. We played the score to Drive Angry by Michael Wanmacher last show. No Strings Attached by John Debney. The Blue Valentine film score is going to be available soon this month. The Right, which is the new Anthony Hopkins film, that has a soundtrack that's going to be available. Hey,
Who did the soundtrack? Right.
I can go on our website and find out.
Okay.
All of these soundtracks are available at moviegeeksunited.net/media, which is the same page where you can get our look up the film books that we've discussed the show, as well as all the DVD Blu-ray releases. moviegeeksunited.net/media. And there's also the In Treatment soundtrack from Richard Marvin, and we'll be playing that score at the end of the show, a little piece from that score.
Right. Cool. But have you heard the blue? I don't remember the music from Blue Valentine, and I have to be honest with you, I don't. I like Blue. Well, like might be the wrong word. I thought Blue Valentine, like Revolutionary Road, they're awesome. Awesome performances, but it's such a bleak movie. But yeah, but I don't remember the music.
Well, it includes like a song from Ryan Gosling, actually.
Cool, a very underrated actor. I know we said that many times on this show, but just incredibly underrated.
I still haven't seen Blue Valentine. I mean, I think that and Rabbit Hole are the two that put both barrels in your mouth. Double feature, you know. It's
yep, you can say that.
It's like the Leaving Las Vegas Dead Man Walking double feature of this year.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
I remember watching those back-to-back in 95.
Oh, my God.
Both, like, exceptional movies, but, geez. I begged for a Rob Schneider movie after that.
Yeah, I know, yeah, you definitely am. Dude, there's another one who will always have work as long as Adam Sandler's working.
Yeah, I know. You know, they shot Waterboy here where I live in Lakeland. Did you know that?
No, I did not know that.
Yes. We're famed for Waterboy and My Girl and Edward Scissorhands.
That's a nice thing to be, especially Edward Scissorhands. Wow.
You know, Last Tango is on Blu-ray now, too. Oh,
wow.
I'd love to see that on Blu-ray.
Yeah, definitely.
That and All the Presents Men and Network just got the Blu-ray treatment.
Oh, awesome. Those are some really awesome things to have on Blu-ray. I mean,
yeah, Last Tango is such a sumptuous movie.
Mm-hmm.
I can't
imagine.
That's
made for Blu-ray. I mean,
yeah. Mm. All right. So what else? What else we got? What else is going on? Are you watching the Grammys tonight?
I'm gonna watch Californication, and I might watch some of the Grammys. No. Well, here's the thing. I'm very happy. Arcade Fire, Black Keys are up for Grammys.
Right.
Mumford and Sons. I mean, these are all CDs I actually own and like a lot. I like Eminem. I never bought this Recovery CD because I didn't think Relapse was anything really to write home about. I really just couldn't get into it, so I never bought Recovery. So I was really shocked when they got all these nominations. I didn't realize.
Well, apparently Eminem didn't think Relapse was anything to write home about either. That's why he worked extra hard to kind of apologize for that release with this new album.
Yeah, I definitely want to get it, but I'll try to watch some of it. I know Bob Dylan's performing, right?
Mm-hmm.
On there tonight, so yeah.
You know, Barry's nominated tonight.
For what? Which category?
I don't know, like best pop, traditional pop album, I think.
Cool.
For the greatest love songs of all time.
There you go. You saw him recently, didn't you?
I did.
Why didn't you talk about that?
Because this is Movie Geeks United.
All right, okay.
not Barry fans hiding.
I know,
from
I know,
the public.
I know. But people, I don't think
Geeks
people
United.
Would mind. I don't think people would mind.
It was good. You know, I've been watching him since I was, well, I've been a fan of his music since I was 3 years old. I've been watching him in concert since 85.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a dozen concerts or so I've seen of him. And I knew that this was, unless I make a trip to Vegas, this is the last time I'll see him. So
mm-hmm.
It was bittersweet. A lot of, like, younger women there screaming and hollering and carrying on. Two, unfortunately, sitting right behind me.
Oh, dear.
Oh, God, I love this song. And they would not shut up. I was like, if you love the song, I would think that you'd actually stop and listen to it.
Yeah, don't you hate that when you go to concerts and people are just, like, talking? Just, like,
yeah.
You know, just be quiet. Just come on. You paid all this money. Come on. Just please be quiet.
But you never know. I could have hooked up.
No.
But I didn't want to say anything. Yeah, but it was fine. It was good. And, I don't know what... the movie, Liam Neeson's movie, comes out Friday. That'll
be good. Unknown. That looks good. That I definitely want to check out. It's got a big cast. Aidan Quinn, January Jones, Diane Kruger. I mean, who else is there? There's another Bruno Gans. I mean, everybody's in it.
Yeah. Well, it's a good time to be in the Liam Neeson business.
Yes, it is. Definitely. So he's going to kick major ass here, too,
he's doing
I
well.
Think. It.
My God, he's in everything. He's branching out. I mean, pretty soon he'll probably be like a breath mint. I mean, he's an industry upon himself.
Mm-hmm, there you go, the Liam Neeson industry.
So I think that's it for this weekend.
Okay.
Unknown.
Yeah, unknown. Oh, and also I Am Number 4 opens up, too.
Oh, Hollywood Reporter has a story about the star of that.
Mm-hmm.
They actually wrote a story about him, and he's already, like, egomaniacal beyond his status. He's very demanding, and reports haven't been good about his behavior.
This is the guy, the star of it, the kid?
Yeah.
Wow.
I thought it was odd for Hollywood Reporter to do a story on that.
So, wait, has this kid been in anything else, or...?
Yeah, well, he's got a lot of big movies coming up, actually. I mean, out of the blue, he came out of the gate with a lot of projects. I'll get to them in a second. I'll try to look them up.
I'll do it. Let me see. Let me go there. I have no idea. I just know it's a DJ Caruso film, really. Timothy Oliphant's in it, right? I think.
Yeah, I think so. Meanwhile, Spider-Man... The Broadway show Spider-Man.
Okay, oh God, yeah.
It's been hit with two Department of Labor violations this week too. I mean, this will not stop. This flurry of, you know, it's like a downpour of bad karma on this show.
Wow. You know? Okay, here Alex Pettifer.
Yes.
He's in Beastly. Yeah, I guess that just comes out the following month. Now, The Mortal Instruments and The Seventh Son. Well, yeah, he does have a lot of stuff coming out. And he was in Alex Rider, Operation Stormbreaker. Okay. And Wild Child. No, some of the, I have heard of these, but I don't know anything about him. So he has an attitude. He's copped an attitude.
Yeah, yeah. I'm looking up the article so I can be more specific about
okay.
it. Did you see the SNL last night with Russell Brand?
I watched some of it. It's like the first half. It was all right. I mean, some of the stuff. I thought the British movie trailer was hilarious.
That was funny. Yeah, that was great. I actually saw the full-length trailer to his version of Arthur.
Okay, what do you think? Honestly, what do you think of it?
Doesn't look great.
It's not. He's not a drunk. Is he not a drunk in this one?
He sure doesn't seem to be, but apparently he is. But
okay, I didn't get that feeling at all.
Going against playing it obviously drunk to wave off any comparisons to Dudley Moore. I guess. I mean, because who played drunk better than Dudley Moore?
Yeah, no, that was part of the film. It's really interesting. I watched this. Someone had put the original trailer up, and it says, don't you want to be Arthur or something like that is the constant tagline. So it was interesting to compare them and how different they are in tone. But they have the same plot line, obviously. He's going to be, if he doesn't marry this girl, he's going to be cut off from the family fortune. And, you know, it's the same kind of thing. It looks like Helen Mirren really looks like the star player in this one, though. It looks like if you're going to
with
anyone, she's going to be like the it looks like the possibility to make the movie worthwhile, if anybody.
In a way that Gielgud was in the original.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Charlize Theron has joined Prometheus, Ridley Scott's movie. And Tom Cruise is going to be in the movie musical based on the Broadway musical Rock of Ages.
Yeah, I saw that. Wow.
And he's going to be in the musical. He sings a Bon Jovi song, right?
I think so, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Can you see that?
I've seen that happen? Stranger Things. I could see that.
So he's inheriting a role that was originated by Constantine Morales from American Idol.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. More and more, I think that Hailee Steinfeld will win Best Supporting Actress. I think the tides are turning in her favor.
Okay, I'd have no problem with that. Do you think that's because of the Melissa Leo shot herself in the foot?
She's definitely helping, yeah.
Okay. Wow, okay, so yeah, Holly, yeah, I could see that. That would be a major upset.
Yeah, yeah, it would be. Well, I guess.
That's
I think she's actually...
I guess Colin Firth, if someone beats him, that would be a huge upset. But it seems like that Christian Bale is just, that's his, like it was for, like we said, like for Christoph Waltz last year. But it seems like, though, there is this, Annette Bening could upset Natalie Portman.
It's a possibility,
it's a possibility, but there is talk of it.
I just, anytime I try to go outside of the color outside of the lines in my predictions for Oscars, I always get burned. I mean, the winners are pretty predictable by the time the Oscars come around.
Right, true.
Arnold Schwarzenegger wants to come back and start doing movies again.
And what will his first movie be? What does he want to do?
He hasn't announced yet. He's just announced, I'm ready.
Well, maybe he can be in The Expendables too. He can be in that.
Give me your offer. Yeah. So, he'll come back.
That will be an interesting to watch that unfold.
Did you see the new X-Men trailer?
Yes. I'd be honest, I think some of the casting is great. I just think it's... Marvel did this as we were talking about Marvel. You know, they did this because they have complete control of this franchise, and I guess they want to redo it, but we also have this other Wolverine movie coming out. And even though Wolverine's not in this, I find it all very confusing, to be quite honest with you. I don't know if this is necessary. I mean, this is an enormous reboot. And I just don't know. It's only been 10 years. I don't know.
Who directs this one?
Oh, Matthew Vaughn, who did Kick-Ass.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah. And then I think the most interesting comic book movie is going to be Aronofsky's Wolverine. That's going to be the most fascinating one of all of them. Even maybe more, well, not more so than The Dark Knight Rises, but maybe, just maybe.
Yeah, they're making an Albert Einstein biopic too, which Wayne Wang is directing. How long has it been since we've heard that name, Wayne Wang?
What was the last film he did? Was it Made in Manhattan?
Oh, no. Was that a Wayne Wang? It was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Wayne Wang. He did the God, what is that? It's not the Joy Luck Club, or was it?
Yeah, it was the Joy Luck Club. Let's see. No, he did. Okay. Because of Winn-Dixie, that was all right. Last Holiday, I never saw that with Queen Latifah, which I think was a remake. And yeah, Einstein, which was just announced, but he's got, there's a Chinatown film project. Oh, that's a documentary.
Every time I think about Winn-Dixie, or hear that title, Because of Winn-Dixie, I think of this murderer, this psycho from the 80s here locally where I live.
Oh,
His name was Billy Ferry, I think. He went into a Winn-Dixie because the red in the sign Winn-Dixie reminded him of communists. And he just started blowing people away.
Oh my God!
In a local Winn-Dixie, and then they nabbed him, and they went. He had bodies buried in the back of his house and everything. It was terrible. So I know that Because of Winn-Dixie is supposed to be like a heartwarming family movie, right?
Right. Yeah. Wow. You really just you changed that one around.
Yeah, sorry about that, guys. A Hollywood Reporter actually listed 10 easy tips to remaking the Academy Awards. You want to hear where they are?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, this is not necessarily the ceremony itself, but when Bruce Davis steps down as the Academy's executive director June 30th after more than 20 years. It will create the most significant leadership shift in the organization's recent history. So here's how they move ahead to change the Academy. Put an outsider in charge is their first tip. It needs to be a visionary to define its mission for the future. Somebody not inbred, not someone old school that will do more of the same, I guess is the point. Scrap the Academy Museum. Davis made one big mistake, committing to a $400 million movie museum to be built near Hollywood and Vine. Land has been bought, but it's on hold until the economy changes. But there are better ways to spend their money, so kill the idea.
Mm-hmm.
Redefine their membership. The Academy has 5,755 voting members. That means people that lost their connection to the business years ago are still voting and making key decisions.
Okay.
The Academy must make room for genuine change. And one way is to move anyone out who hasn't been in the business for at least 10 years.
Oh, that's going to create some...
To non-voting status.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
Mm.
Fix the foreign language rules. The Academy keeps defending its mind-boggling foreign language process whereby each country nominates one film, comparing it to the Olympics. So think China, Iran, or North Korea are as serious about aesthetics as they are about athletics? Think again.
Oh, wow.
Go back to 5 nominees for Best Picture.
They did it for ratings. Go back to that, but I don't think they are. I think that's going to be around for a couple of years.
Yeah, I mean you gotta keep it around for a couple of years if you're gonna try it to begin with. You really need to give it a good long trial run before you declare it a failure. Last year, the Academy upped its number of nominees from 5 to 10 in the Best Picture category to get better TV ratings. It was presented as an experiment, and the Academy got lucky with 10 legitimate nominees. But what if a clunker like Burlesque or The Tourist made the final 10 as what happened at the Globes? Stick with 5. That would not happen with the Academy. Extend the president's term is another suggestion.
Mm.
Hire the right Oscar host. Ever since Billy Crystal stepped down, the Academy has searched in vain for the perfect Oscar host. It got credible reviews with Hugh Jackman 2 years ago. But controversy helps. Who's the awards host everyone's talking about this year? It's Ricky Gervais. If he is too busy in 2012, then what about Sacha Baron Cohen?
These are interesting choices.
He was scotched last year. I mean, he was under consideration by the producer, Adam Shankman, of last year's ceremony. And gosh, would have been a much more lively, entertaining show if they did pick him last year.
Yeah.
So
We'll have to see. I'm curious though, what James Franco and Anne Hathaway will. That's a big question. I don't know. I think it should be good, but I just don't know.
Well, they like the idea of people actually, young people in the industry actually hosting this night.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they chose the two of them, apparently.
Okay. We'll see. I mean, I have no problems with it right now. I think
also. They suggest to be transparent. Tell people, and I like this idea, tell people the percentage of votes. You know, like, who was second place?
Yeah, no, that's a good, no, that is good. I agree with you.
I like that. I don't know how they'd incorporate that into the actual ceremony, but that would be cool if they could do that.
Because
of a landslide is a win? How close is it? I mean, that would be a story that would linger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. Oh, definitely. That's a good idea. I like that idea.
I do too. All right. Anything else going on?
No, I think we covered a lot tonight. Are we back on Wednesday?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I think let's see. The Academy Awards are two weeks from
tonight.
So we won't have a show 2 weeks from today.
Okay. You don't want to? Okay. No, that's cool. I mean, we normally do, but I understand if you don't. I mean.
Well, maybe we will.
Maybe just an hour. Just an hour show. I mean, just a.
We didn't last year because I was in Dallas, and that went so well. So maybe we will have a show.
Okay, just like an hour show. Just like we can also talk about if anything. We can talk about Drive Angry.
We could talk about your favorite topic, what the stars are wearing.
Yes,
so,
no, we will. Definitely. We'll definitely be talking about the fashion.
I want you to study up on designers and such. And,
I actually know a lot about design, so this is something I could actually do. This is actually something I could do off the
top. Do you really?
I could actually. I mean, I don't watch like the Joan Rivers thing where she goes, she castrates them the next day or anything
I do.
Like that.
That's funny. Okay. I find that funny.
But no, I do. I know. I might have to do this show downstairs then, so I can watch E or whatever. Well, no, ABC might have it on. So when we're doing it, so okay, I can watch it. Well, don't worry. If you want to do that, we can do that.
Right. They will have it on. ABC will have it on.
Okay.
So,
well,
yeah,
no, I'm going to do it. I want to do it. However, I want to be able to watch it in HD so I can get an accurate description. Tell you exactly what they're wearing and everything.
Yeah.
All right.
That'll be good. I'll enjoy that. So Jerry's fashion commentary. Precede the Oscars.
Yeah, I'll just like say, oh, she looks really great with that dress on. That's an awesome dress or something. That would be the extent of my commentary. I wonder how much that ran her.
Yes. I'm pretty sure I will be pleasuring myself to that dress tonight. That's all the guy critiques you need to make about.
Oh God,
Oscar
we're
fashion.
Gonna be we should be shot. Well, I'll be out of material within the first 2 minutes. I mean.
All right. So we'll do that like 2 weeks from tonight before the Oscars. Does that sound good?
Yeah, that sounds good. No, we should just do something. I mean, we should definitely just do because it is our big night. And we should do come on. Maybe Chris will be on too, and we can just any last minute thoughts or predictions. Anything? Maybe something new, something outrageous has probably happened, some scandal or something.
Yeah, that'll be good.
Yeah.
At our next show, I think we'll be about the love of film, like film love. We'll welcome on two of the authors that we've talked about tonight, Richard Pepperman and his memorable movie moments book, and Robert Elder, who wrote the book The Film That Changed My Life. I think that'll be our next show. And then we'll have our Oscar series next week.
Cool.
And then our Kubrick show, March 6th.
Sweet.
Okay, so let's come back Wednesday night. Why not?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Glad we could figure this out during.
Yeah, I'm glad we did it on the air.
Yeah. All right. We end tonight with Richard Marvin's score for the HBO series In Treatment, which is being aired again. Man, that's a major commitment, that series.
I got to watch it more often. I don't watch it enough, so.
I mean, a series is a commitment to begin with, but you're talking about, you know, individual actors being individual episodes that occur throughout the week. And I don't know how they're dividing them now. It used to be all 5 nights of the week was a different plot.
True, true.
Man, that's huge, man.
No, it is. That is it. You're absolutely right.
All right. So we'll end it with this piece of score. We'll be back with you guys Wednesday night.
Okay.
Thank you, Jerry.
No, thank you. Have a good night, man.
You too.
Enjoy.
Go to MovieGeeksUnited.net, guys, for the latest on the show. Also, follow us on Twitter, MovieGeeksUnite at Twitter.
Awesome.
And our fan page on Facebook.
Sweet.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.